Hi, I'm Andrew. Welcome to the Reviewer 2 Dives Geoengineering podcast. I'm here today with Gunter Flipkins, and we're going to be talking about coastal weathering and ecotoxicity. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Okay, so I understand that you've listened before, but yet you're still willing to come on, which is a bold step. So you know you're going to get minced. Let's start off by getting a full title of your thesis and where you resided when you did it.
So the title of my thesis is Coastal Enhanced Olivine Weathering for Climate Change Mitigation, Investigating the CO2 Sequestration Potential and Ecotoxicological Risks. Or I recently finished my PhD last month and I conducted it at the University of Antwerp in Belgium.
And what was that like? Was it a good place to study, or would you recommend avoiding Antwerp?
Yeah, it was quite nice.
Are you Belgian yourself?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
From Belgium.
I don't have any strong opinion about Belgium. The Monty Python famously described it as a place needing no nickname because it didn't have enough of interest to justify it. So you have been studying this in field research, doing lots of kind of samples of water and coastal rocks and stuff like that, or have you been doing it on a modeling and desktop approach? What's the methodology that you've been using to investigate this?
It was mainly lab experiments that I did. So it's not yet allowed to distribute olivine sand in like the Belgian coastal area. So all the experiments that I did were in the lab on a smaller scale.
Well, Project Vesta have done olivine distribution, haven't they? Couldn't you have just gone and got samples from their experiment and done that? Or is that not what you were trying to look at?
Yes, that's true. They have done some field trials, and we also collaborated with them on their field study in Hawaii. So I also helped them with the trace metal analysis of the biota samples over there. So I did collaborate with them on that part, but for my PhD it was mainly focused on laboratory experiments, since in Belgium it's not allowed to distribute olivine in the coastal environment.
And did they pay you for the work that you did or not?
We got to an agreement that I would be on the publication of that data, that if when it comes out. So the answer to that is no, they did not pay me. I volunteered to on their samples.
Did it for exposure then? That kind of famous way of getting free work out of people. We won't pay you anything, but we'll give you a credit. Something like
Yeah.
that, right?
Yes, indeed.
And what were they like to work with? Did you get the impression that Vesta are a pretty professional crew, or did you have concerns about the way they were doing their thing, or what?
Well, I wasn't there when they collected the samples, so they just collected the samples and sent them over to me. So I've only had like sh short meetings with the people from Vesta. So I can't really comment too much on how professional that the research is that they conducted or that they're conducting.
And what's your academic specialty? Are you a biochemist or an environmental chemist, or what is it that you do precisely?
I actually studied biology, so I'm a biologist. So I did my master thesis on ecotoxicology, on metal toxicity in fish and in common carp. And after that, I got the opportunity to start a PhD, coastal enhanced olivine weathering, because there the trace metals are also mainly nickel and chromium are of potential concern. So that's how I got involved in coastal enhanced olivine weathering.
So just to recap the basics, I understand that olivine is a relatively abundant silicate mineral, and it's got trace nickel and chromium, as you say, and potentially some other trace elements that you might have concerns about. And then when it weathers out, it's weathering. Is it weathering into a solid form, or is it weathering into the water?
It's weathering into the water, so it dissolves, it releases silicic acid, and it consumes and cations such as magnesium, iron, nickel, and during that weathering process, it consumes protons, which leads to an increase in seawater total alkalinity, and that can then drive atmospheric CO2 drawdown.
Do you find that their ecotoxicity issue is caused by the weathering products or by the trace elements in the rock? What's the issue for the ecosystems?
The problem is that so yeah, the concentrations of nickel and chromium are quite high in olivine, and so they are released during the weathering process, and depending on to what concentrations they accumulate in the environment, they could be bioaccumulated and then cause toxic effect in marine biota. But really little research on that until now, while it might be an important factor to investigate. I think you're still muted, Andrew.
Yeah, can you just pause the recording moment? I've just got to step out of the vehicle for a moment.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
You're muted, I think. Oh, hang on. I've got sort of my headphones are disconnected. That's the problem. Give me a second.
What was known previously about the ecosystem risks from this weathering, and what did you learn during your PhD?
Regarding the risks, there was actually quite little known. The number of studies when I started, so I started my PhD in 2019, the number of studies on ocean alkalinity enhancement was also very limited back then. And those studies that were discussing olivine weathering, they were mentioning that trace metal or that nickel and chromium release could lead to concentrations that significantly they are significantly above background levels. And more than that, there was actually not known about, yeah, the ecotoxicological risks.
So you've been taking this concept into the lab and then working out what actually happens to the beasties, right? That's the basic concept. Is that correct?
Yes, so I looked at two aspects. So the CO2 sequestration potential, which is like the weathering rate, which of the olivine, and also the trace metal release rate. And then I conducted a couple or a toxicity test with amphipods, and also an experiment in which I looked at if amphipods and marine snails avoid olivine sand because of its high trace metal content or any other reasons.
What are amphipods?
Amphipods are like small crustaceans, so they look a bit like shrimps. They're omnivores. They are important in ecosystems as by grazing and decomposition of organic matter, and they're also important prey species for wading birds, for example.
So, did you only look at these two groups of species, or did you look at the ecosystem more generally?
No, my research was focused on those species. So at the start of my PhD, I was working mainly on the weathering experiments, which took quite some time. Then I also did like a theoretical study, so based on existing environmental quality standards, which are like regulatory threshold concentrations for nickel and chromium in the environment, I derived like a first conservative olivine application guideline based on that. And then afterwards, I conducted the toxicity tests with the amphipods and with the snails.
And did you find that just those indicated species alone was enough to investigate the ecosystem risk?
There is still quite some research needed. Indeed, you need to look at more species need to be tested for their sensitivity to olivine and its reaction products. And then we're also mainly thinking of those species that are known to be sensitive to trace metals such as nickel, which could be sea urchin larvae, for example. So that would be something that can be done for follow-up research.
And how do we know what is and isn't sensitive to these trace metals?
Well, that's known from years of laboratory ecotox testing that have been done during the past decades. So there is already a lot of nickel and chromium toxicity data out there, which gives indications of what concentrations of nickel and chromium are safe. And so based on those studies, those big range of studies, you can already get an idea of which species would be sensitive and which ones would be not.
So, was your experiment specifically looking at the interaction of the species with the source of the heavy metals? So, you're saying that you had snails kind of crawling over the sand, and did they not like the taste of it? That kind of thing. That was the sort of investigation method, was it?
So it's two experiments or two types of experiments that I did. One was a toxicity test with the amphipods, in which they were exposed to either pure olivine sand in small beakers or to mixtures of natural sediment and olivine at different concentrations. And there I looked at metal bioaccumulation in the amphipods, so how much they accumulated over certain amounts of time when exposed to different olivine grain sizes or amounts, and also looked then at the effects on survival, growth, and reproduction of those amphipods. And then for the other experiment with both the snails and the amphipods, I specifically looked at if they would avoid olivine sand. So that was setups where we had, for example, with the amphipods, olivine on one side of an aquarium and natural sediment on the other side, and then looked at how much time that they spent on each compartment to see if olivine would be avoided or not.
And did they avoid the olivine or not?
Yes, both the snail and the amphipods avoided pure olivine, but mixtures of olivine and natural sediment with concentrations of olivine up to 30% weight percentage, that was not avoided.
A bit like baked beans with hidden vegetables for children, that you can blend a certain amount of vegetables into your baked beans before the child notices. Claims that these are not legitimate baked beans and refuse to eat, right? It's a similar process.
Yes, indeed. You can compare it to that.
Intestine's quite acid, right? When worms and things like that eat the olivine, they can speed up the weather.
Yes, that's indeed the theory that the ingestion of olivine grains, that the acidic gut environment would speed up the weathering process, and therefore also the trace metal release inside of the guts. I did not specifically look at waterborne versus, the uptake of metals from the water versus the uptake from the olivine grains themselves. But doing some calculations with the potential weathering rate of these particles in the gut environment, I found that the dietary exposure, so the exposure to metals via the gut, could be an exposure pathway, because we did see quite a lot of olivine grains in the guts of exposed amphipods. But more research, dedicated research on that is needed to unravel how important that it is as an exposure pathway.
So you chopped up your amphipods and looked at what they'd eaten, basically, to establish the degree
Yes.
to which they've ingested the origin. Okay.
Yes. So
Did you have to get ethics approval for this, or did they just regard all invertebrates as being lacking in qualia, and therefore you can basically do what you like to them?
indeed, for invertebrates, except for like squids, for example, there is no ethical forms needed to do the experiments.
What sort of scale are you talking? Did you research on tens of animals or millions of animals or what?
The total amount of amphipods and snails, I would say around 1,000.
Across all of the experiments you did, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
Are you confident the species that you're investigating are the most important ones? Because I would have thought that the top predators are much more important.
The concept of that's like biomagnification, so that you get higher concentrations higher in the food chain. That's not necessarily the case for all metals. For example, mercury, then there that's the case, that you would expect high concentrations in your top predators. But for other metals, it's not that pronounced. There's also, of course, a distinction you need to make between essential metals and non-essential metals. So essential metals they are typically well regulated in organisms. And then I'm thinking of, for example, copper or zinc, and non-essential metals, those indeed are accumulate more easily in biota, such as cadmium or lead.
Copper and zinc. Are you saying that these are essential or non-essential?
They are essential.
Yeah, because I've got both of those in my vitamin pills, I'm pretty sure. And obviously, you don't have lead in your vitamin pills. You don't want to be eating that. So you're saying that the
Indeed.
ones that are non-essential tend to accumulate. Is that right?
Yes, I mean the essential metals can also accumulate, but the organisms, they are better and regulating those concentrations in the body so they can more easily, yeah, regulate them. And it's the toxic levels are generally much higher than those for non-essential metals. So for non-essential metals, you could already observe toxic effects at relatively low concentrations compared to essential metals.
That makes sense. You'd expect that you wouldn't get toxicity of things that you actually needed to eat. So your experiment showed what in terms of toxicity on these animals? I mean, you showed that the avoidant behavior was quite limited. I'm guessing that if you've got common environmental minerals, then the animals would be evolved to avoid things that were bad for them, right? So it's not like you were feeding them on custard creams and Haribo. You know, these are things that they would naturally find in the environment. And if they don't like the taste of them, they'd stay away because they're toxic, right? So, you know, olivine is available at the surface in significant parts of the world. So as long as these ranges overlap for these creatures and the rock, you'd expect that the animals would be able to modulate their behavior so as to make sure they're not compromising their biochemistry with toxic concentrations of minerals, right?
Yeah, so olivine is indeed present at various places in the world, but like the really olivine rich places are quite limited, I would say. So, and the idea of coastal enhanced olivine weathering is also to distribute it in those areas where organisms are not yet exposed to olivine, and it would also be distributed in quite fine grained material that potentially weathers quite fast and releases trace metals quite fast. So organisms are not necessarily adapted at all locations to these nickel and chromium exposures. And what I found, so with the amphipods, we observed that the accumulation of the metals, as you would expect, is dependent on the amount of olivine that you expose them to, but also the grain size. So smaller grains resulted in higher metal accumulation, which can be explained by the faster dissolution and thus the higher nickel and chromium concentrations in the water that they were exposed to. So marine organisms, they can take up metals via their diet or from the water. So via respiration, via their gills, they can take up metals or via the ingestion of food. So that's the two main pathways of metal exposure. If you have high concentrations of those metals in your sediment, then the dietary exposure pathway could be significant, while in other cases, your waterborne might be more relevant. The dissolved metals are generally considered to be more bioavailable, meaning that they are more easily taken up. So the metals are available in a free ion form. They can be more easily taken up compared to when they are bound to, for example, organic matter in the sediment. So it depends on the concentrations as well that are present in your food or in your water.
And are these animals selective feeders, or do they just hoover up everything that's near?
I think that they eat actually quite like everything to get like the organic matter from the sediment. Given the fact that we observed so many olivine grains in their guts, I would assume that they're not very selective, that otherwise they would not eat those olivine grains because they don't contain like much organic matter. So I don't see the reason why they would eat them if they would be selective on their feeding.
Is it your expectation that they're leaving because the concentration of organic matter is too low for their liking, or because they specifically don't like the taste of the olivine?
So for the snails, we found that they actually avoided the olivine due to its pale green color. So it was actually the color that led to the avoidance of the olivine.
How do you know that?
Because we conducted, so we had like a small plate on which we put the snail in the middle, and then around it we put several substrates, so natural sediment or mixtures of olivine with sediment or pure olivine. And then we looked which substrate that they would cross in order to reach the food source, which is sea lettuce for the snails, so a sort of seaweed. And so we observed that they avoided pure olivine. And when we put the substrates underneath the plate instead of on the plate, we also observed that we got almost identical results. And based on that, you can exclude like the trace metal content and the grain size to matter. So leaving only the color of the olivine that could explain the results.
Well, that's really interesting. So you're saying that they're behaviorally avoidant, but it's optical, not chemical, right? The
Yes, but
color
for the
is, but that could be like an evolved response to basically stay away from green rocks because green rocks are toxic, right? So the animals avoid green stuff. And do you believe that that's because they don't like olivine or because they've learned to avoid some other kind of green stuff?
Well, previous studies have actually found similar results for the snail that I tested, the common periwinkle. They said that it's probably because the snail has innate attraction to dark shapes because that's the environment, like the crevices between rocks where they would be safe from predation and also from desiccation. So that would actually be the reason
So
why they
they just
avoid.
don't like the light, basically. It's not necessarily the green stuff, but it's just that olivine's quite pale, and
Yes,
therefore it freaks them out, right? They're like vampires, creatures of the night.
yeah,
Okay.
indeed. But that was only the case for the snails. So for the amphipods, they did not avoid the olivine because of its color or shading. So there we could not say with certainty what would be the reason for the avoidance, but based on previous studies which mentioned that this amphipod is occurs on a range of different substrates. We actually think that it's possibly due to the high trace metal content of olivine, and so that they try to avoid trace metal exposure by not being on the olivine sediment. But we couldn't prove that for certain.
So the amphipods didn't like the olivine either. And what kind of concentration did they need before they would get upset about it and try and leave?
So it was similar as the snails. So it was only the pure olivine that they avoided, and olivine sediment mixtures with concentrations of olivine up to 30% were not avoided.
So you can basically give these animals quite a lot of olivine in the sediment before they get freaked out. So you might have like a kind of small proportion of the like embayment or whatever you're dealing with, or estuary, or wherever you decide to place your olivine, where you're going to have a problem because you've got a lot of local concentrations. There's maybe sort of 50% or 60%, whatever. But when you're in littoral waters and you've got the stuff being relatively well spread out mixed to the sediment, the animals are not really going to care behaviorally in terms of their avoidance of it, right?
Yes, that's at least what we find for these two species, that the behavior would that they would not avoid it at like relevant concentrations for a coastal environment. However, that would not mean that there would not be any adverse effects, other effects like growth or reproductive effects at lower concentrations, which we did observe for the amphipods.
So what do they do? Did they just give up having sex with monks and join a monastery or what?
Yeah, so the olivine exposure resulted in reduced growth, and that then was also resulting in reduced reproduction. So due to some amphipods not being sexually mature at the end of the experiment, so I started with juveniles and I looked at the growth throughout or by the end at the end of the experiment.
Olivine is a puberty blocker for amphipods.
Yeah, you could say it like that. It's because of the toxic mechanism of the trace metals probably
And was
that
that a
leads to
dose
reduced
dependent
growth.
effect? Does it tend to restrict growth kind of linearly or similar? Or is there like a threshold where an effect kicks in after a certain amount?
We did. It's more or less that an effect kicks in after a certain amount because, as we said earlier, metals are regulated in the body, so toxic effects will only occur when your accumulation or in certain active compartments in the body of these organisms exceeds certain thresholds. So that means that if the accumulation if the excretion is not fast enough and you get accumulation to toxic levels, then you will see reduced growth.
Does that happen at a certain threshold then? Is that similar to the 30% threshold for behavior? Or does it have to be lower or higher to get that effect?
Well, that depends. A lot of factors. So the concentration that they are exposed to is relevant to determine the rate of accumulation of the metals. And so also the olivine concentration at which you would see effects. In our case, we used very fine-grained olivine sand in the toxicity test. And we only conducted water changes twice a week. So the concentrations that they were exposed to were quite high. And in that scenario, we observed adverse effects of olivine exposure at concentrations of 10% olivine and higher.
But is that similar to what you'd have in a normal weathering environment? I mean, like, typically, I guess, your sediment concentration would be still quite high in a normal weathering environment because you want to get as much rock broken down as possible and weathered in the environment. But because you have circulating water, I'm guessing that their exposure through absorption from water, be that through their skin or be that through their gut, is going to be much lower when you don't, when they're not growing in a fish tank, basically.
Yeah, indeed. The dilution effect that you would have in a real coastal setting would play an important role in like reduce the concentrations that they would be exposed to. So that's really, yeah, something to consider when deriving the safe amounts of olivine that you could supply in certain coastal environments.
Yeah, but did you actually try and account for this in your experiments? It's all very well to go and have this concentration going to infinity and beyond in your little beakers or mesocosms or whatever it is you use. But if the water concentration is just nothing to do with what they would normally be exposed to the environment, then are we really learning anything other than that you can upset an arthropod by giving it too much nickel?
So, yeah, in my toxicity test with the amphipods, the concentrations were high, not unrealistically high. They could still be reached under certain conditions when you have quite long water residence times. But like model calculations, simple calculations that I did based on like normal water residence times did show that in the water column, your accumulation of metals would remain relatively limited in most cases, so that you would not easily exceed existing environmental quality standards for nickel or chromium.
Okay, so summarizing all of the things that you've told me then about these different situations, that you've got an avoidant behavior, about a 30% threshold for the snail type creatures. I can't remember which ones of those they were called.
The common periwinkles.
The common periwinkles, right. And you get toxicity effects which kick in at about, say, 10% sediment concentration, but those toxicity effects are linked to water column concentration, which wouldn't necessarily follow the effect or wouldn't necessarily follow the proportion on the sediment, because you'd normally have a lot more flushing in the open ocean, right?
Yes, indeed. So that's something very important to consider when comparing also different results from different studies that will appear in the future. So it's really important that we look at what concentrations they're actually exposed to, the nickel concentrations, and then express that on how much olivine can be supplied.
So your most worrying finding was that these animals don't develop into adulthood, which is obviously pretty catastrophic if you're an animal, because like if it delays your development, and even if it doesn't actually kill you, I mean, you said that you had animals that didn't develop at all by the end of the experiment, which is obviously reproductively catastrophic if it doesn't ever develop. But even if they do develop later on, then they've still got the risk of predation during that period, right? And did you run your experiment for long enough to see if their sexual reproduction was affected? Did the experiment design just not include that? Because it may be that they just grow up ugly and no one will my horse to sleep with them and never get asked out. So that would be pretty catastrophic as well. But did you assess their life cycle or just the actual, the individual kind of life arc of individual animals as opposed to their ability to procreate, successfully raise children and college and all the other things that you might do if you're a crustacean?
Yeah, so our experiment was long enough to for the juvenile amphipods that we started with from for them to in the control at least to mature and produce offspring. So we could look at the number of juveniles in the different treatments, and we saw that for high olivine concentrations there were no juveniles at the end of the experiment. It was only 35 days, so if we would have done it for longer, then there possibly would have been juveniles. We don't know that, so it could be just delayed reproduction, which would all not be good, as you say, because of increased risk of predation or also lower food availability for other animals that live in the environment and that depend on these amphipods as their food source.
Are you sure that this isn't a controlling issue? Because it's possible that, for example, one of your tanks was warmer than the other, right? And that might affect. So have you checked it very carefully for other explanations or?
Yeah, the experiment was conducted in a climate chamber at a constant temperature, and we also monitored the temperature in the tanks. So that cannot be a reason for differences in growth or reproduction that we observed.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one example. Do you think
Yeah.
there's anything you might have missed or not?
Not really. So I don't know what other. It looks quite clearly that it's metal toxicity. We also did observe like a significant metal accumulation in the amphipods that was dose dependent.
And then the other one was avoidant at what levels?
The avoidance was at concentrations of 30% or at pure olivine, and the toxic effects were at 10% and higher for the
Yeah, but
reproduction.
okay. So, you said that both species tended to avoid olivine that was above 30%, or only one?
Both species avoided pure olivine, and they only did a toxicity test with the amphipods, not with the snails, so I didn't look into that for the snails.
Okay, so what I think you're saying, therefore, is that at relatively low concentrations in the sediment, you don't expect any particular problems for the animals. And even if you did, there would be a sort of conservative buffer in place, which would prevent you from exceeding your toxicity thresholds because of the way that you are flushing out any abatements with material, right? So water comes in and it sweeps away the dissolved nickel and cadmium. The sediment concentration of 10% cause problems for the animals, but in reality, that might not be quite as bad as it looks in your lab because you would be flushing the environment with fresh seawater rather than just relying on the levels building up like they do in your physical systems, right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, fine. So, how much of a showstopper is that? Then, I mean, like you've got this possibility for toxicity, but do normal distributions of olivine exceed that 10% threshold where the toxicity might start to become an issue or not?
Well, it's not really certain yet at what concentrations the olivine will be spread out in coastal environments. That's going to depend on in how many regions they spread it, how much carbon dioxide removal that they want via coastal enhanced weathering. So there is no like real numbers, but I would guess that concentrations would be lower than 10% olivine in most cases. And then, of course, it depends on the accumulation of the metals in the sediment and in the water column, if that would cause any effects on marine biota. Because, of course, I only did one toxicity study. You could have organisms that are more sensitive and that would already be affected at lower olivine concentrations. So yeah, that's difficult to say based on the limited or my studies and the limited other studies that are out there currently.
So do you think that this technology is going to be viable or affected or not?
I think it could be effective until a certain scale, which needs to be carefully considered. I think site on a site-specific basis. So for areas where you would have long water residence times, you would preferably spread less olivine, and you would be more careful in the amounts that you would use. And if you would know that there are sensitive species that are living there, also adjust it based on that. But yeah, the weathering rates that I observed, they were in line with other experimental findings. So I think that it could be a feasible method, but there is more ecotoxicological research needed to be more confident on safe concentrations.
And bearing in mind what you know about different species, are you confident that you've picked the right ones to look at? Or could there be some other species that are even more sensitive?
Yes, there are definitely species that are more sensitive, like sea urchins, for example. So they are a good, they would be a good follow-up test organism to work with for future experiments.
And how much of a showstopper or otherwise do you think this is? Do you think this is going to be a very difficult hurdle for people like Project Vesta to overcome? Or are you confident that the distribution patterns will make little difference to marine life in due course?
Yeah, again, it's really difficult to say because there is limited studies on olivine exposure effects on marine biota, and yeah, based on limited data also from the field trials, for example, by Vesta, those do show limited metal accumulation, and so the effects could indeed be limited if you have enough flushing of your reaction products or your nickel and your chromium to the open ocean.
Do you know of standards in this space? Like, for example, isometric. So I think they've got something going on with ocean alkalinity at the moment, if I'm not mistaken. And it suggests to me what you're saying, that this could have quite a big effect on the ecosystem and potentially some downstream negative consequences. Obviously, these species, that they've got a degree of sensitivity, right? And it's possible that they could just stop using it in oceans where these animals are present, or alternatively, they might have to actually stop doing the whole thing altogether. So, which is it likely to be? Is it just a matter of taking more care, choose locations carefully, or is it more a matter of we need to stop doing olivine weathering in these circumstances completely, rather than kidding ourselves that we're actually making some difference? Maybe we're not making a difference. I just want to draw you on that point.
Yeah, I think just careful consideration of the application sites would be important, because you also, of course, have the benefits of spreading olivine sand, not only the negatives of the nickel release, and those might significantly outweigh the negatives from the nickel release. So I think it would definitely be possible, but just careful consideration of the application sites seems like important to me.
Okay, so you're basically saying that you found an effect which enables people to have an indication of what toxicity is occurring in terms of any heavy metals accumulating in their bodies. You don't think that that is as critical a concern as it might be with, say, mercury or DDT, but nevertheless, it suggests monitoring carefully, particularly in early stage sites where we don't have a clear plan moving forward of what we need to do to select the right sites. So you're saying that a degree of caution is merited, right?
Yes, indeed.
So this research surprises me a bit. It doesn't sound like 3 years' work, whatever it is you spent on your PhD. So what was it? Am I just underestimating the amount of work you've done, or were you working on other stuff at the same time? What?
So I also did some weathering experiments to look at the effect of waves and currents on olivine dissolution rates, because there is this hypothesis that waves and currents would enhance the rate of olivine dissolution, but there is no like experimental evidence on that. So that's the other part that I worked on. So it's not only the ecotox part, but also the weathering and CO2 sequestration part.
Okay, so you've managed to appraise to what extent this actually results in CO2 sequestration, right?
So I looked at the effect of physical agitation on olivine dissolution and found in small scale lab experiments that olivine that was continuously rotated, so similar to the movement that would occur in a natural environment due to wave action, that olivine was dissolving 8 to 19 times faster than stagnant olivine, which has important implications.
My understanding is that that's because of several effects. So you've got an increase in mineralization of the material, so you've got more CO2 coming to the surface, which makes it small. So you get like a kind of self-reinforcing process. So the chemical weathering is actually accelerated chemical weathering. So you're constantly breaking fresh slices off this other thing. The second effect is that you've got wave comminution. So you've got the wave smashing against the olivine, breaking it up. And the third is that you've got bioturbation. You've got animals that are drilling into the soil, picking this stuff up, eating it normally, and then exposing it to carbon dioxide. So that's one part of how open ocean weathering may be rather quicker than what you've got in the bottle in the lab, right?
So we did not actually observe any significant changes in grain size distribution of the fresh and the weathered olivine. So like breaking off small pieces of the olivine grains was limited. Grain fragmentation was limited in our experiment, in our short-term experiments, because we also what we did see is that there were micro cracks developing in the grains. So over longer time scales, grain fragmentation might be an important pathway to accelerate olivine dissolution, but in our experiment, it was mainly probably due to the flushing of reaction products at the grain scale that enhanced the weathering process.
Okay, so do you think I've got a fairly good handle on this paper now, or do you think that there are areas that you haven't covered?
I think we've discussed most important findings. Yeah.
And how long did it take you to build all this? Because as I say, it didn't feel quite like 3 years. So, how many experiments are you running, and what proportion of your time are you spending on lab work and field work versus doing write-up and teaching and all the other responsibilities you might have?
The PhD here in Belgium are for 4 years, and it took me a total of 4.5 years to from the start until my public defense. And the experiments, like, it took quite a while to set them up because also there was no previous work done on most of these things, so I had to figure out a lot of stuff, which sounds all quite easy maybe, but it was actually not. And so like the first 3 years, I did mainly the most experiments, and in the fourth year, I focused on writing.
That's a lot of experiments. Yeah, I mean, you've got to do a lot of engineering development, as you rightly pointed out, before you can actually run an experiment. But Hugh Hunt describes that as doing an experiment on the experiment, which is probably not far off
Yeah,
the truth,
indeed.
to be honest. That's certainly why. What's your plan after your PhD? What are you going to do thereafter?
And so I'm going to do a postdoc at also at the university. We're also continuing working on mineral-based ocean alkalinity enhancement.
Okay, and is that looking at stuff that dissolves in the water column rather than stuff that weathers slowly on the sediment floor?
No, it will also be on stuff that slowly weathers on the sediment floor.
And are you going to present your results from this at Goldschmidt or any other conference series?
For this year, I don't have any conferences planned yet, but the past years I did present some of my work at different conferences, like the Negative CO2 Emissions Conference and CTEC also.
The Oxford Negative Emissions Conference, which is the latest one in that series, is frustratingly oversubscribed. My co-authors and I worked on a methane review paper, and review papers are normally given quite prominent billing at these things. I remember seeing Sabine Fass's review paper, which they, I think it was two or three papers that she did, and they were given a plenary billing, but we couldn't even get in the conference. So it's obviously not been very well thought out how much demand there would be.
Yeah,
So,
I've heard that. One of my colleagues could
yeah, a
also
lot.
not go, apparently, because yeah, there was
Yeah,
some.
I think they've upset a lot of people in the sector by doing that. I mean, that's a pretty I think that's a pretty fundamental failure, to be honest, if you've got a conference that is not right sized, because that negative emissions conference is one of the most important in the conference season for this field. And to have, like, I think a half or two thirds of the people who want to go unable to go, I mean, that's quite a big faux pas on the part of the organisers, I think. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not sort of genuinely critical of a lot of people in academia other than just being wrong. And, you know, you're not asking me wrong. You're in the wrong place, really, aren't you? But, you know, when a major conference series like that, I've been to, I think, two or three of those negative emissions conference series once before. And they are pretty significant. And I've read some, you know, just got a paper. It's had its revisions now. It's going to hopefully get published unless we've done anything catastrophically bad in the revision process. That was founded on a collaboration that I forged several years ago, like with Stefano Casarini, if I'm pronouncing his name correct.
Those,
without those collaborations, without the opportunity to go to conferences and meet people, then it really is harder to build that professional network and keep the mill turning, right? You've got to be able to go and meet people and exchange ideas and look at their work before, you know, you can make scientific wheels turn. And to have a massive conference like that completely screwed up by bad organisation is really disappointing. There's another one that was one of Marines. I might prefer going to smaller conferences where there's a lot more focus on the content. And the Atlanta one, I'm probably not going to do that much on marine weathering, although I was looking at doing a lot on it previously. And we were, Stefano has led the two papers I've done. He's been like the kind of professor who's coordinated, got funding and found the students and everything like that to work there. And I don't think he wants to pursue this anymore. In summary, therefore, what have we learned from you? You've got to make sure that you're not providing too thick a layer of sediment. You want to make sure that you're quite sparse and spreading out. You don't want to be perturbing the sediment so that you're pushing the olivine deeper layers of the sediment, because it won't weather, you won't get enough water flowing over it to exchange carbon dioxide in the environment. So it really is going to encourage people to thin out their distribution patterns, right? That's probably the key lesson I'm picking up, as well as the need to monitor these things. So have I got the basics of your paper there? I understand it correctly, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary.
Okay, great. Well, I know you're on a limited time, and I'm going to have a day off reviewing paper today. I'm not going to bother to tell you whether I like it or not. I'm going to do the typical review and tell you response of just not submitting a response, despite multiple reminders and chasing. I'm just not going to bother telling you what I think of the paper. Just going to ignore it, because it's about holiday in England, and I mistakenly put call for when it's a bank holiday, and I don't feel that I really deserve to be made to work on a bank holiday. So I'll do the call, but I can't be bothered to tell you what I think of your paper. So you neither get a review or two boot print or a review or two gong to confirm that you have passed review, rare though they are, but you're even going to not be denied the pleasure of being flung out of our studio and tumbling towards the ground. So that is that, unfortunately. You've got to go, and I will let you do so, unless you have any last moments before you are ushered out of our studio. Is there anything else you want to say, or is that it for this week?
No, that's it. Thank you for having me, Andrew, and enjoy your holiday.
Look forward to seeing future work. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.